Ready for the first matter of U.S. v. Wright?
Good morning. May it please the Court, AUSA Donovan Kokas on behalf of the United States.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
The only question before this Court is whether district courts have the inherent power to dismiss with prejudice grand jury indictments simply because two petit juries can't come to a verdict. That question, like all questions regarding the scope of a district court's inherent power, is reviewed de novo. So said Judge Becker in Holland v. New Jersey Department of Corrections in 2001.
But is there any point, because I was kind of analogizing in my own mind to the statute of limitations, and the district court did not find any prosecutorial misconduct.
Correct.
And in your brief, I'm not sure if you wrote the brief or not, but the brief by the Commonwealth, I think four times talks about the strong case, and one time I think the brief said the very strong, but incredibly strong case the prosecution had. The jury didn't see it that way. I know that's not the issue here, but well, I guess what I'm getting at, does there ever come a point where the number of retrials based upon no evidence at all constitutes a constitutional deprivation on the part of the defendant?
Your Honor, I think there would. It would be a constitutional deprivation, but not something that could be remedied through inherent powers. And I can give Your Honor five different ways that the defendant could argue that if there comes a point.
Right.
I don't think we're there yet.
Okay, I understand, but give me those ways.
Okay, so for example, in Bartkus, Supreme Court case 1959, Supreme Court said there may come a point where multiple prosecutions become so harassing that those violate due process. In this case, there was never an argument or even an insinuation that we were prosecuting Mr. Wright to harass him or that we'd reached any point of harassment yet, but that would be one.
Is that something that has to be intentional? If the number rises to the level that it equates to a harassment, does it matter if the Commonwealth is driven only by the U.S. attorney here, not the Commonwealth, mm-hmm. But the government is motivated only by so-called law and order interests in prosecuting crime?
Well, and I don't know, Your Honor, because we just don't have cases that deal with this. I mean, the Bartkus case I just cited dealt with multiple sovereigns prosecuting a defendant for the same act. But I'm just arguing or pointing out that that potentially could be extended to this. Maybe even take the Russell Supreme Court case from 1973, which says government conduct may become so outrageous that it's fair to bar the courtroom doors to it. No argument that our conduct here has been outrageous or even improper. Maybe, even under this court's Schoolcraft decision from 1989, a defendant could argue vindictive selective prosecution on the theory that, hey, you are re-prosecuting, you are retrying the case way more times than you would have against other similarly situated defendants. Again, no argument about that. The district court's order never once mentions due process or the Fifth Amendment. It's all strictly about the court's inherent powers.
Does one necessarily exclude the other? To get at it, one, you could try to get it through something of due process issue, or if you can proceed with the process claim. But could the court, being concerned, I'm not suggesting this is what happened here, but maybe, could the court have a level of concern which would justify it or motivate it, take justify out of it, because then I know your answer is going to be no, but motivate it to intercede at a point where the court believes that there's something very unfair, or maybe not to the level of a due process violation, be it substantive or procedural, but there's just something wrong. It's a duck test. It's walking like a duck, it's quacking like a duck, it's starting to smell like a duck, and so the court decides on its own that since there's no new evidence being introduced, this wasn't the case of 11-1, and I know the court didn't consider it in its opinion, but we're not talking 11-1 with one counselor and juror. It doesn't agree with jury nullification. Your whole case is built around police officer testimony, which apparently is not very credible. So the judge decides whether they're letting this continue at some prejudice to the defendant looking at 15 years in prison if convicted. I'm just going to step in and put an end to it.
I think it has to reach the level of a constitutional deprivation or prosecutorial misconduct. That was this court's decision in Santini in 1992, which is still good law, says that it's improper for a court to intrude on the decisions in the prosecutorial domain unless those decisions either amount to a constitutional deprivation or prosecutorial misconduct. And the key word there is decisions. All we have done is we made the out-of-courtroom decision, which we're entitled to do, in fact responsible for doing under Article 2, to retry this case following a hung jury. And so based on that, I mean, because of the Article 2 implications, I think the court needs something stronger than just its personal notice, you know, personal notions of fairness to do this.
And in fact, in Hastings, the Supreme Court sort of alluded to that concept. Would you agree?
I would agree, yeah. In fact, I mean, I think the defendants have a point when they're saying Hastings may not be an exclusive list of the purposes for which inherent powers may exist. But then subsequently in Williams in 1992, the Supreme Court said, well, okay, but Hastings deals strictly with district court's ability to control their own procedures. And that, I think, dovetails with in-bank court's sort of taxonomy in Eash about the categories for inherent power. So we don't have this, the ability to dismiss an indictment following hung juries is clearly not within Article III's bailiwick. It's clearly not essential to all the other powers. And I don't think it's of an order of magnitude so much greater than all of the useful to have type powers that I don't think you could put it within that category. So even though the Ninth Circuit, for example, has said in bank in, I think, W.R. Grace, well, you know, we're going to not hold Hastings to that list, the particular inherent power that the in bank court recognized was the power to order the government to disclose witnesses, that clearly falls within the third category, at least, of Eash. This is just simply nothing like that.
You know, sir, just Rule 31, which is, I guess, the main part of your argument.
I'm sorry, Ron?
Rule 31, which is yes. The main part of your yes. argument. Just that.
Yeah, so the way I read Rule 31 is that two things happen. I mean, it's two sentences. The district court can grant a mistrial if the jury is unable to agree. That happened here both times. Manifest necessity, the defendant never objected to a mistrial either time. Neither did we, for that matter, although we might have had we known this was a possible consequence. So mistrial was granted properly, no dispute of that. And then the second sentence is the government may retry on any count in which the jury was unable to agree. The way I read that syntax is the only leave of court we need is the original decision to grant the mistrial. As long as that's proper and there's no dispute that it is, then we may retry the case based on our discretion.
And your position is it can be retried as many times as the prosecutor believes appropriate, so long as it doesn't violate due process, constitute outrageous government conduct.
Yes, or prosecutorial misconduct. Even
I didn't see you going that far. Are you putting it that far? As long as there's no prosecutorial misconduct, good faith prosecution, can retry him as many times as you want to with no new evidence, no new nothing.
Well, prosecutorial misconduct I'm thinking of is a category separate apart from a constitutional issue.
Take it out of it.
Okay.
Because your answer surprised me.
I'm sorry.
Your answer surprised me. So forget prosecutorial misconduct for a second. You're saying that there's no limit whatsoever, barring prosecutorial misconduct, to the number of times the government can retry somebody following, and I'll make it more complicated, a closely divided jury. They can't reach a decision in the declaration of a mistrial.
Well, no, Don. As I mentioned before, I think it's also true that it may become unconstitutional at some point. So apart from prosecutorial misconduct, there may be, you know, remember Barkis, which I mentioned, Schoolcraft, Russell. All of those may be other avenues. I can even, as I'm standing here, one more occurs to me, which the defendant could make a Sixth Amendment argument that he's being deprived his constitutional right to a speedy trial. That sounds a little out there, except I happen to know the Third Circuit is yet to weigh in on where the responsibility lies for delays caused by mistrials.
So is it your position then the court can't use its inherent authority to act as a limitation on Rule 31's
permission
to allow the government to try their cases?
Correct.
It's got to be a constitutional, it's got to be a due process problem primarily, or some kind of misconduct of sorts.
Correct. Perhaps even, you know, like a failure to prosecute, you know, foot dragging, that kind of thing. But it's our position the court doesn't have the authority to do otherwise.
Right. So when you talk about speedy trial of sorts, you're talking about constitutional speedy trial
correct.
Violations, and we have that covered in Rule 48.
Correct. Yeah, correct. And see, the reason I read Rule 31 that way is it would have been the easiest thing in the world for the judicial conference to add at the second sentence, the end of the second sentence of 31b3, comma, with leave of court. That's what it does.
You've never been in one of those meetings, have you? The easiest thing in the world.
No.
That comma would have taken about 2.5 years.
Well, but regardless, Your Honor, I mean, we apply the maximum statutory interpretation of exclusio unius to this. The Letterman Supreme Court did applied it to the federal rules in 1993. I think we have to assume that because the rule, Rule 31, prescribed a particular manner of operation, omissions are deemed to be exclusions here. There's no evidence to the contrary. The other thing I'll mention in the course of this is I was reading something from Oliver Wendell Holmes, Justice Holmes, who'd said something like, a page of history is worth a volume of logic. Here I think the history is quite telling because we don't have, you would expect, I would think, to find a lot of cases, especially early on in the Republic, where courts were reaching out and using this inherent power if it existed. And I think that's because pre-1967 in Chapman, when the harmless error rule becomes a real thing, trials were reversed for any error whatsoever. So I found Supreme Court cases where one guy was convicted 4 times and each time, the first 3 times, came back for prosecutorial error, and then he's finally convicted the 4th time and that's affirmed. You would think if there were inherent power, it would come into play in a situation like that where at least you could argue the error was, we bore some responsibility for that. Nobody bears responsibility for a hung jury. It's just something that's happened.
When was that one case?
This I can get it for Your Honors. It was like 1899. It was a long time ago. And it wasn't uncommon really up until the late 60s to see a mix of, you know, reverse because of error at trial, then next one's a mistrial because of a hung jury, you know, back and forth.
In fact, most of the cases, I don't think there's any that you see 4 trials, maybe 5, and right. That happens when there's like a reversal and a remand back.
Correct.
Are you relying at all on separation of powers as part of your argument?
We absolutely are, yeah. So the Loving decision in 1996, the Supreme Court said that separation of powers prevents one branch from intruding on the decision-making or impairing the decision-making of another branch. In other words, impairing another branch's ability to comply with its constitutional obligations. Here, the district court is not merely impairing our ability to do that. It's actually blasting that out of the water. It's forbidding us to do this. I just don't see how, in reading this court's in-bank decision from 2013 in Quinn, if it's a separation of powers problem for judges to grant judicial use immunity, which this court held it was, and I think both of your honors were on that panel, I don't know how this much more drastic step wouldn't also be a separation of powers problem. And fundamentally, that's where, you know, we land on this. I would just point out, I know I'm out of time on this and I'll be back, but I just point out 2 unintended consequences, perhaps, if you were to find an inherent power in this case. One is, in my experience, when you prosecute cases like police brutality or excessive force, it can be very difficult to get a jury verdict in those. You get hung juries are not that uncommon, and in my experience, district judges don't always like those cases. Are we going to be okay with district judges throwing those cases out under an exercise of this inherent power on something of such public importance? The other implication is this. If you were to find this inherent power, now every time a district court declines to exercise that inherent power, I think that has to be an appealable final judgment. Because the defendant obviously, you know, if he goes to trial and is acquitted, he's not appealing. And if he goes to trial and is convicted, it's too late. So are we going to be okay with the delay that would build into the process? Are we going to be okay with all of the extra work that's going to mean for the Court of Appeals? And that's not illusory. Pennsylvania has actually had to come up with a rule to preclude or severely limit defendants' rights to take appeals following motions to bar trial on double jeopardy grounds. Now those actually have to be certified as non-frivolous. Are we ready to go that route? I mean, you've got to take the bitter with the sweet, I think. Anyway, I'll be back.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. Mr. Chandler, do you have any questions?
No, all my questions have been asked and answered. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, Renee Petropalo for Appellee Ramont Wright. The one thing the government said, they started off by saying, yes, there has to be a limit on the number of times that the government can retry a defendant, but those limits are only in the Constitution. That is actually undermined by Supreme Court case law, which explicitly holds that supervisory authority is an appropriate tool to remedy even those injustices that do not amount to a violation of the rules or the Constitution or statutes. And that's as recently as 2016 in Dietz, the court recognized it didn't have to be a violation of a rule or a statute for the court to step in and exercise its supervisory authority. They've made clear that courts have inherent supervisory authority to achieve justice in the results, and that's actually what Ish says in the en banc opinion from this court. They also have the inherent power to preserve judicial integrity by ensuring that a conviction rests on appropriate considerations before the court, before the jury, excuse me. But that's Hastings.
But didn't Deist also say that a court can't act contrary to a rule, statute, and a constitutional provision? And couldn't one argue that by doing what happened here, the court was acting in at least contrary to Rule 31 and maybe even the mandate that the executive has the authority to enforce the laws?
Your Honor, I disagree. Rule 31, the Supreme Court, in answering those questions in different contexts, says it's not enough for rule to touch on something. The rule has to make clear that Congress intended to supplant this inherent supervisory authority of the court.
How clear could they be? They may be prosecuted.
They've talked about permissive language not being sufficient.
How else could the court word it? You couldn't have a rule that required the government to bring a prosecution. So doesn't it have to, the word may have to be there. You couldn't, this is not the kind of a rule where you could put in language that would be obligatory.
Well, the advisory committee notes actually say, with respect to this rule, that it's only intended to be a restatement of existing law. And existing law is really Perez and progeny. And Perez, the general rule in, before Perez was the government gets one chance to bring a case to trial. And Perez came down and said,
he jumped in his way back machine and took us back to 1898.
I'm in 1824 with Perez.
Since 1824, yes, retrials were permitted. That's what the case was.
So Perez says there's no mechanical rule barring retrial under double jeopardy. Doesn't bar mechanically, but it doesn't mandate retrial either, and it doesn't speak to what other limits could be on the government's authority to endlessly retry a defendant.
Well, sure, there's plenty of case law that says the Constitution's going to operate as a limit. Your adversary concedes that.
Right, exactly. And what the court did here in exercising its supervisory authority, it invoked its supervisory authority, but it was guided by constitutional principles.
But it did not conclude there was a constitutional a matter of constitutional magnitude that's been implicated as a result of the retrial. The court was pretty careful that it was relying on inherent authority as to the reason why it thought it needed to bring an end to this prosecution. It did not find any violations of any sort of misconduct. It was praiseworthy of both sides.
I understand. I turn the court to the Rivario decision of the United States Supreme Court, 353 U.S. 53. In that case, the court exercised its supervisory authority to require the government to disclose the identification the identity of a confidential informant.
But that was so that the defendant could confront the evidence against him.
I understand. And later cases by the Supreme Court, Valenzuela Bernal, make clear that the exercise of the supervisory authority was guided by constitutional principles, as you just mentioned, the Confrontation Clause, and the defendant's right to present a defense, Sixth Amendment right. And that is, I submit, what the court did here. She exercised her supervisory authority guided by principles of double jeopardy, Speedy Trial Act, and due process, because she's saying, if you look at the language of her opinion, inherent authority to effectuate the speedy and orderly administration of justice to ensure fundamental fairness, weighing the circumstances and specific facts of this specific case, allowing a third trial risks doing a disservice to justice in a potentially irreversible.
In the one situation, if the government had waited a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then come in and said, okay, we're going to retry the case. To me, that's a very, very different scenario. But here it was a matter of weeks, and they came in and said that they're going to retry the case.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that undermine the argument that you just made?
I don't think so, Your Honor. She's dismissing and barring a third prosecution. One of the most significant reasons is she's recognizing in that last sentence of her opinion there could be a potentially irreversible injustice to Mr. Wright, and that is the foundation of the double jeopardy protections are that it's recognizing that there's the chance of conviction increases, even though the government's evidence doesn't change. A conviction becomes less reliable. The chance of an innocent person being convicted on the same evidence increases. For all the reasons that are set forth in Arizona and Green, the court has an or the government has an opportunity to hear the case, try out its case.
If the court were concerned about the bona fides of the evidence, it has Rule 29. I know in both Rule 29 motions, the court was quite clear that she felt the evidence was sufficient.
Of course, it has
so,
to
I mean, still, so if there was a concern about an innocent person, that is a person for whom the evidence did not support conviction beyond a reasonable doubt, the court has another a mechanism of addressing that.
She
so I was surprised by the statement at the end of the opinion that talks about the likelihood of conviction increases.
A judge doesn't have the authority to grant a Rule 29 motion when, as in this case, the evidence is entirely one contested element in a very simple prosecution, entirely dependent on police officer credibility. So that's up to the jury to weigh the credibility. The court can't step in and do that. What she's doing is recognizing a fundamental concept underlying double jeopardy and due process, and it is that there's an increased risk with each prosecution that a person, though innocent, will be convicted, and it's only because...
I tend to agree with you. My gut says that. Is there anything on the record to substantiate that?
The last sentence of her opinion, a potentially irreversible injustice. Based on, she cites Green, she cites Arizona, but there are a wealth of cases from the Supreme Court, Tibbs versus Florida,
United States versus DeFrancesco.
The basis of the court's opinion, you mean, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm. Not the legal basis, the factual basis. What is the factual
the
basis
factual
for the
basis.
Judge to have said it is a likelihood of an increase in conviction the more trials that occur?
The words that she used in her last sentence are the best evidence for that. But she's throughout the opinion.
What is it based on? Because you can make the contrary argument and say the more somebody, even assuming they're telling the truth, the more someone repeats a recounting of the same episode, the more likelihood it is that the 10th recounting of that is going to vary from the first, unless they're reading from a script running at the witness stand. So every time the officers testify, they're going to say something different from the way they testified before, and you could argue from that that there's a greater chance of acquittal because the jury is going to be made aware of the fact that their in-court testimony is different from the way they told the story before.
I don't think that the empirical evidence bears that out, Your Honor.
We have none of that in front of us, I think, is our point.
It's just studies. The Supreme Court has recognized and commentators have recognized the likelihood of conviction increases for all the reasons that we've discussed and that the court discusses in the opinions in terms of the officers can subtly change their testimony. And we're not talking about lay witnesses. We're talking about professional police officer witnesses who will be reviewing the testimony before they testify the second time. That's what happened in the second trial. The government got rid of one witness who offered contradictory testimony. The government was Officer Henson was surprised at the first trial with the mistake that he made. At the second trial, he preemptively corrects it and calls it an embarrassing misstatement.
What's the thing with somebody, one of the witnesses, maybe it was Henson, who said that they saw somebody else, a non-officer?
Yes, that was Officer Henson. And in the second trial, he preemptively tries to correct that mistake. Officer Fowler testified at the first trial, I saw Mr. Wright speeding, and that's why I did the U-turn. I started chasing him. None of the other officers backed him out. In fact, they contradicted him. And at the second trial,
He's 90 miles an hour. That's significant.
I'm talking about the reason for the initial pursuit. Officer Fowler said it's because I saw him speeding. They do the U-turn, and they start chasing. In the second trial, they don't call Fowler because no other officer backed that up. He was speeding later. That's uncontested. But we were talking about the initial reason for the stop. And that all goes to the defense that this man was targeted by aggressive, proactive policing in a minute away from his home.
The district court's decision wasn't based upon her appraisal of the bona fides good faith of any of the witnesses.
Her opinion was based on her exercise of supervisory authority, based on and guided by principles of due process, double jeopardy, and the speedy
trial. Let's talk about separation of powers. How do you get around your adversary's points concerning separation of powers? It's the executive's authority to decide when, where, and how often to try someone, as long as there's no misconduct, prejudice to the defendant, in their ability to defend. And so the separation of powers issue, I'd like you to speak to that if you could.
Right, I have a couple of responses. One is the government's rigid view of the separation of powers was actually rejected by the framers. They don't intend separation of powers to be an absolute, require absolute independence, but they have a system of checks and balances. So one branch is permitted to and required to check another branch.
And in fact, I think your adversary would concede that when he started to list out when there's a due process violation, that's when the court can step in.
Mm-hmm. The idea that the Supreme Court and also this court in Fahey either held or recognized that there is the supervisory authority and that it exists and allows courts to dismiss information or indictments in other contexts.
So Fahey was a Brady violation and there had to be prejudice to the defendant in order to permit the dismissal.
I understand.
Again, and the reason why I keep bringing that up is there always seems to be in these cases where dismissals are discussed some kind of bad conduct on the part of the prosecutor or its witnesses or prejudice.
Fahey is different because they were dealing with a specific violation of a rule. There's already a body of law there that provides for a remedy and circumvent that body of law. I understand that. But Fahey stands for the proposition that a court does have supervisory authority to dismiss an information in appropriate circumstances. The Supreme Court has said it as well, and that sort of undermines the whole separation of powers argument. The other idea is that the government relies on...
I'll say your reason, because I don't want to cut you off, but I've got to be somewhat mindful of the clock, more mindful than I normally would be.
Oh, I apologize. I was just going to say they rely on Nixon, but Nixon talks about there actually was one branch talking and, quote-unquote, interfering with another branch. But the question is, does it destroy that other branch's general assertion? Here they're making a general assertion of the need to prosecute gun crimes. Their right is not destroyed because they brought the case not once, but twice. They fully and fairly had an opportunity to bring the case to conviction twice. So there has been no destruction of the government's authority under Article 2.
Okay, Judge, do I have any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Lawrence S. Lesberg from Gibbons, P.C. on behalf of Amicus Curiae, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Just through all the years we've known one another, I think it's the first time you've ever argued in front of me, going back to 24 years.
It's an amazing thing, isn't it?
We both lost our ear.
Yes, we have.
But you all look fabulous.
I really appreciate you using up some of my 5 minutes to discuss my
appreciate. All right, go ahead. Let me start by asking you 2 points. One point in particular, Mr. Cook has made a very, very good point. That any opinion that comes out of this is obviously going to apply to people other than Raymond Wright. And you know better than me, given your work in this area, the number of times when the government tries to try police officers for use of excessive force, the number of hung juries that come out of that is not insignificant. Your argument would mean that a judge who wanted to, after, maybe even after the first mistrial, but more likely after the second mistrial, certainly after the third mistrial, if the judge was on client, could cut off the prosecution. And that may be the situation of jury nullification that we don't have here.
Yeah. I think you've focused on exactly the question before the court, which is there a limit to the number of times a person can be retried? Over and over and over. The court, in its opinion, says under the government's theory, a person could be retried, assuming no other constitutional violation, as many as 50 times, and that would still be fair.
Well, you did say there comes a point at which there's a due process violation.
But let's assume for the moment no specific due process violation, that it's just a retrial over and over, that the government just keeps trying to make it a little better each time. And let me just parenthetically say, as far as the empirical evidence of whether there's a greater likelihood of conviction in subsequent trials, that's not really a matter of evidence or science. It's really a matter that's been accepted by the Supreme Court in case after case after case. If you read Green, for example, one of the things that the court's concerned about in terms of the decision whether to grant a mistrial, which I'll come back to, is the question of whether is the fact that a retrial is more likely to result in an unjust conviction. This is not me speaking. This is the United States Supreme Court. But to your point, it may be that after one trial, there shouldn't be a retrial. It may be that after 3, maybe after 10, after 20. What this court's job is, and you're focusing correctly on what kind of opinion ought to come out of this, there ought to be an analysis. There ought to be an analytic framework that courts can use to judge this question. And you're not writing on completely a blank slate because a number of state Supreme Courts have, of course, created just such an analytic framework.
So that's
framework.
What you want to do is adopt New Jersey's multi-factor test?
You know, honestly, not necessarily New Jersey's. The government makes the point that there are other factors that a court might want to consider. They point to a 12-factor test and some other 12-factor test. I think that this is a significant enough issue that the interests of justice are sufficiently implicated in a regime where you can try somebody over and over and over, that rather than just looking at this case and saying two is not such a big deal, you go ahead and have a third one, that what the court ought to do is say, look, there's a series of factors that we ought to consider. One factor, Judge McKee, that you've talked about before is the evidence going to change very much? Because it does seem wrong that if the same evidence is going to be put forward over and over and over, and all that we have is our government witnesses who have learned from their prior cross-examination what's likely to come before them, that it just doesn't seem right to just keep trying over and over. And I know when I say it just doesn't seem right, that sounds a little colloquial, but that kind
it's
of is
what we have here.
It's kind of what interests of justice are all about. It's kind of what supervisory power is all about. But here, I would urge Your Honors, as you think about this, and I have very little time, so to look, and Mr. Koch has suggested this as well, at history. This case is fascinating from a historical perspective. We talked about cases going back to 1896 and cases going back to 1824, and it really has to be fit within that framework. And the rule, as Ms. Petropaolo, whose name I can never pronounce, said, is also based on the history. So let's look just for a second at the rule. Let me, if I could, just talk about that history, and then I promise I'll sit down. The rule, 31b3, it doesn't just grant the government carte blanche to do whatever it wants. 31b3 itself is called mistrial and retrial. The first sentence talks about the circumstances under which a district court can grant a mistrial. That's whether you call it manifest necessity or whatever. That has been a subject that has puzzled and which the courts and the Supreme Court in particular for many years. Courts look at that question about whether a mistrial was appropriately granted, and in doing so, and I would urge the court to look at this court's decision in Webb and in Russo and in the underlying Supreme Court decisions in Gorey and Downham and Jorn and Somerville and all the way back to Perez. One of the things that the court looks at over and over is the burden that will be placed on a defendant by a retrial. And in courts, because there are issues that arise as to whether a mistrial should have been granted. And in deciding whether a mistrial should have been granted, it looks at what the consequences of a retrial would be. Will it be more likely to result in a conviction, perhaps an unjust conviction? What's the burden? So Webb talks about repeated attempts to convict an individual, thereby subjecting him to embarrassment, expense, and ordeal, and compelling him to live in a continuing state of anxiety and insecurity, as well as enhancing the possibility that even though innocent, he may be found guilty.
But there the problem was that the court intervened into the arguably the deliberative process and didn't let the jury finish its work. It kind of asked the question of the foreperson, are you guys hung yet?
Completely
right?
Correct.
And so wasn't the real focus there is to make sure judges understood their role vis-a-vis the jury process?
That was one of the things. So the question there was partly that, but the specific issue before the court was the court therefore correct in granting a mistrial? Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is that the notion of mistrial and the notion of retrial are inextricably intertwined. And that's the only right, and historically that's so. And so that's the only right way to read Rule 31b3, which is that the first sentence grants the right of the discretion to the district court whether to grant a retrial. That discretion is bounded. It's bounded by just these sorts of concerns. And the history of these provisions is such that one of those concerns is the issue of retrial. And so the question before this court is, are there going to be any limits other than constitutional limits, other than due process or prosecutorial misconduct, as to how many times a defendant can be tried? And respectfully, it is the NACDL's position that there are such limits, and that what this court ought to do is, in order to provide guidance to future courts, to impose, as other high courts, state high courts have done, a rigorous analysis. You may not agree with the specific analysis of the New Jersey Supreme Court, which was deployed by the district court here. You may not agree with the specific way that the district court engaged in that analysis here. The government certainly doesn't. But the real question is, shouldn't there be some way for lower courts to look at this? Because this is now a bit of a problem. You have a district court judge that felt it was just wrong. And she wasn't the only judge to have ever done that. There are two other district courts that she cited, one from D.C. and one from the Central District of Illinois, that had come to a similar conclusion. And so it leads inexorably to the notion that, without offending separation of powers at all, because after all, courts impose constraints on prosecutorial decision-making all the time, whether it's pre-indictment delay questions, not necessarily, you know, a fault, or not necessarily a matter of misconduct, those notions are not absolute, and they should be bounded by the type of analysis that allows courts, lower courts, with this court's guidance, to do what is right and fair. That's what supervisory power is for. That's the type of analysis that other courts have engaged in pursuant to their supervisory power, and that's what we request that the court do here.
If your time is up for a while, let me go back to the first question. I suppose there's the Goose versus Gander rule that Mr. Kalkus argued, and that was the scenario I first posted to you that you didn't respond to, and I think I understand why. But no matter what kind of analysis we have, say it's the Abadi test or one like that, which seems to be a very thoughtful analysis that the district court relied upon out of the Supreme Court from Jersey, it's going to work both ways. So if we have the much more common situation of a police officer or officers who routinely would try, after two tries, comes back with a mistrial based upon corruption offenses or excessive force, that same rule is going to allow a judge to say, you're not going to retry, even if we get to jury nullification. It seems that, this is not based upon evidence, it seems like you're likely to get jury nullification in that kind of scenario with some frequency. And what would prevent that jury nullification from then putting an end to the retrial ability?
Your Honor, what is good for the goose is good for the gander. And I believe that if there's a rule that applies to criminal defendants, it applies to criminal defendants whether they're police officers or people like Mr. Wright, who was a citizen, you know, and presumed to be innocent. The rule has to apply across the board. And what I would suggest is that the framework that this court ought to mandate that lower courts follow is one that would apply to defendants across the board to assure that people aren't tried over and over and over, and thereby increasing the likelihood of an unjust conviction.
But I think that Judge McKee's question might be going to something different. I misunderstand you. Let me know. Yeah. I think what the concern is that a district court judge imposes its own notions of what's fair,
right,
has some particular view about police officers should have some latitude, whatever it might be from their personal point of view, and under those circumstances, one and done. You can only try it one time and you're done.
Mm-hmm.
How do we ensure that the personal notions of a judge don't decide when a trial can't be brought again? Mm-hmm. I think that's what the judge is asking.
Okay, thank you. I need to try to address that question directly, and what I would say is that will turn on the analytic framework that this court imposes. I think an analytic framework like Abati, which is blind to who the defendant is and sets forth a number of factors, how similar the evidence will be, how different it is, are meant to constrain the district court's pure use of its own preferences, its own sense of fairness. Judges should utilize their sense of fairness, that's for sure, but that has to be cabined by particular rules. Where you are today is you're essentially writing on a blank slate, because although state Supreme Courts have imposed a set of rules that can constrain district courts' sense of fairness, this court hasn't done that, nor has really any other court of appeals in the federal system. The Tenth Circuit at one point said, we know that there's a point at which it would be too much, but we're not there yet. It said in a case that's cited in the papers. But the real question is, when would you get there? And when you get there is the kind of thing that needs to be dictated based upon a rigorous analytic framework. The New Jersey Supreme Court did that in Abate. The Hawaii Supreme Court has done it. The Tennessee Supreme Court has done it. Other states have specific rules that set it forth. This rule, because of its history and because of the combination of the discretion accorded to district courts to grant a mistrial and the basis for that, which includes thinking about what a retrial would be, has left it for district judges when they feel that there's an injustice, at least arguably, to impose a remedy. And what that remedy ought to be should be dictated by this court's framework. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge, do I have any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, just to take these in the order in which I remember them, this court in Moravian School Authority in 1994 decision, Judge Nygaard's, I believe, said consistent with Bank of Nova Scotia, consistent with Chambers, Carlisle, that supervisory authority can't, in Judge Nygaard's case, I think the word he used, the phrase he used was be inconsistent with a rule. In this case, it's clear this is inconsistent with Rule 31. On to the issue of whether the district court was correct in citing Green, and this, none of this is meant in denigration of the district court. This is one of the best judges we have in my district. She's decisive and smart. The problem is when the judge cited Green, and it's a very juicy quotation, when you read the sentence right before it, the Supreme Court says, in effect, double jeopardy precludes retrying someone for the same crime after they've been acquitted or convicted. The third category is hung jury, and that's never mentioned. So I think to say there's a double jeopardy violation in principle is like saying someone could be pregnant in principle. There either is a violation or there is not. The Abate test that the appellees seem to be a little cagey about what test the court should adopt, if any. It's our position the court shouldn't adopt a test because this power doesn't exist. But if it did, Abate wouldn't be the right one, and neither would the test prescribed by most of these states, which vary. They're like 6 to 12.
What's wrong with Abate?
So for one thing, the very first factor in Abate is the breakdown of the jury as far as is known. Well, the problem is you'll never get reliable information on that in a federal court because the Supreme Court in Brasfield versus United States in 1926, I think, held that it is per se error for a court to ask a jury on the cusp of a deadlock what its breakdown is.
Right, and the court here was mindful of that. She didn't want to get into it.
Correct.
But we've got the unofficial because the court never accepted its finding. Basically, we know what the count was.
But here's the problem, Your Honors, is that when the court discharges a jury in every trial I've ever been involved, it says you're free to stick around and talk to the attorneys if you want, but you don't have to. In my experience, it's unusual for all 12 to stick around. But more than that,
so that's a factor that just doesn't go one way or the other in the body.
Correct, right? But in effect, it cuts against us because it's our ox that's being gored, Your Honor. We want to do a retrial, and I think the way the court weighed this factor, the only way it could ever favor us is if everyone agreed, if defense and the prosecution agreed, the jury came back some overwhelming number in favor of conviction. And there's just no way of ensuring agreement on that. So that's the problem we have with that factor. And then the other one, as far as the whether the evidence is going to be different in another trial, we don't entirely agree with the court's finding, if you could call it that, that the evidence will be the same. Because one thing that, and Mr. Adepoju was trial counsel, but one thing that trial counsel was permitted to do, and it's in part our fault because we didn't object, but he was permitted to insinuate through these hypothetical questions that the gun might have been planted on Mr. Wright. Well, Mr. Wright never put on a case in either trial, never testified in either trial. There's not a shred of evidence that the gun was planted.
How else? He clearly does not have to testify. How else would you suggest that to the jury? How would you get that thought into the jury's mind, except for skewed cross-examination with police officers and using a suggestion and insinuating an argument?
I think, Your Honor, that's correct, but I mean, it should have drawn objections for facts not in evidence, that kind of thing. I mean, I think the problem is it was allowed to go uncontradicted so that by the time closing argument rolls around, that's an important facet of the defendant's theory. I have no problem with this stuff coming in if there's any evidence at all, if you can get.
But you made an excellent argument, made some very good points. at least to my way of thinking, this is not one of them. Because there will never be any way of getting that evidence in unless you get one of the police officers to, quote, go rogue. And that's almost never going to happen. It's got to be through cross-examination, through inconsistencies, through innuendo. And it may not be fair, but it's clearly kosher in the rules of evidence.
Well, I mean, I don't know that it is if it's a fact, not an evidence. So we can agree to disagree on that or whatever. But I think at the very least we'll be more mindful of watching those kinds of questions. That's all. I mean, okay. Questions that are, you know, inviting some, because it's almost like a nullification sort of theory. But even go to the threshold question before that, for a district court even to ask us how we expect our evidence to be different in another trial, the problem I have with that is you're almost intruding on the deliberative process. And we have a deliberative process privilege where we're not required, as far as I know, to give an offer of proof before we try anybody. I mean, we have to have an indictment that's sufficient. And in order to get to a jury, we have to offer evidence that's sufficient. The court ruled that we did.
It's not a common phrase, say, forgiven witness. In other words, going back to many, many years ago when I was a trial judge, it wouldn't be uncommon to get a defense witness or a prosecution witness. When someone is cold and you've got concerns about what the witness is going to say, you go to sidebar and you say, I want an offer of proof. What do you expect to get out of this witness?
Yeah, and that may be the case if it's unclear, but at this point, I mean, the district court wants an offer of proof about the entire trial. Mm-hmm. And now I'm not saying, you know, I think if there was a privilege here, it was waived because we responded to that in our pleadings. I'm just pointing it out as a potential problem down the road with whatever standard, Your Honor, if you decided to go this route and you decided to adopt a standard, that's a problem, I think. But the overarching problem I have with the entire body standard is you've got to remember New Jersey is a prerogative writ jurisdiction. It's the only one I was able to find still in the United States. And it has been since its constitution in 47. And what that means is, and this is cited in a body, it cites the case, Supreme Court case from Jersey called In Re Ringwood. And what that means, if you read Ringwood, is that New Jersey courts have much more leeway to second-guess prosecutorial decisions. They can throw out a prosecutor's decision if it's deemed arbitrary or even abusive. That's not the case in the federal system because federal courts use separation of powers. I understand there's some permeability there, but they view separation of powers differently. The last thought I'd leave runners with since I'm done is that I think the way to conceptualize inherent supervisory powers, it's kind of the dark energy of the judicial cosmos. It exists.
So you're taking this into the cosmos.
It exists every place where there is authority, some other rule, and it can coexist in other areas that are covered by rule or constitution or legislation, provided it doesn't co-opt that. And I think that's our basic problem here, is that the district court has essentially reached into an area that's reserved to us through Article 2, given, you know, the U.S. Attorney in my district is required to make this decision under 28 U.S.C. 547, and the district court has vetoed it based on, you know, her notions that it's fair to do so. There may be some point down the line where constitutionally it won't be fair to try this man again, or any person a certain number of times, and I can't give Your Honors a number because it depends, but it's our view that this is not the case.
Mr. Lustberg's response, I'm sure he's thinking this mentally, is depends on what? Tell us.
Well, it could depend on a number of things. I mean, so this would be asking me to come up with the test that the appellee should have come up with. I don't know the answer. I mean, one thing that jumps out is, you know, if you had a trial in length of, say, a Microsoft-type trial, and those take like 18 months, maybe 2, 3, 4 of those get to be problematic. But this is...
Isn't it ironic, though, the district court here found this short trial to be one that was too short, so we shouldn't retry it. You've just said a trial could be too long, so we shouldn't retry it.
Right.
But I gather what you're saying in that circumstance is if it's too long, that means now judicial resources are being used, not just prosecutorial ones and defense ones. Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah, it could be. And, I mean, and part of that, if Your Honors read the briefing very carefully, which I know you did, but the way the district court weighed some of the factors, it was sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't for the government. And I think that was an instance where I think that factor should have cut in our favor, and instead, when you read the conclusion, it doesn't. So for those reasons, we would ask that the court reverse.
Do you have any questions?
No, thanks.
Thank you very much. We'll ask for a transcript in the case, given some of the citations. If you could check with Ms. Trevor, she'll go with the details of how to get the transcript. Thank you very much.
Thank you.